In this episode of Shadows from the Tree, we delve into the darker side of genealogy by exploring stories pulled from newspaper archives and using historical records to find the truth behind them. Specifically, in this episode, we focus on the theme of family disputes or feuds and the impact it has on the lives of those involved. Join us as we shed light on those often overlooked stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved faced. Connecting you, our listeners, in hopes that we find one of your ancestors. All right, so today I am in Chicago.
Oh, all right.
I don't think we've done Chicago before.
Chicago, okay.
So I typed in Family Feud in, our little, archive site we use, and I found a couple stories that were good, but they didn't have enough meat to them.
Yeah.
Like, it just would have been quick little blurb, so I kept looking, and then I found an article about a brother. So this one said, kidnapped boy's brother is said to be in the plot. So I was like, what would that mean?
Yeah, a plot in the cemetery is where my mind first.
No, like in the scheme of the thing.
Yeah,
so I'm like, how old is the brother? And then it didn't make sense to me. So, Philip Marino, brother of a missing child, knows the whereabouts of Angelo, his six-year-old brother, the son of Antonio Marino, who was kidnapped from home last Friday. It is believed the Inspector Revere of Chicago Avenue Police Station. So, the police are questioning the older brother because they think he has an involvement.
How much older is he if he knows where
like
he is?
He's like 20.
Oh, geez, okay.
So, yeah. Well, so the kicker is there's a whole history of the families in Chicago, all right?
Okay.
So, there's, the mafia.
Yeah.
Talking speakeasies, and those from the 20s. So, we're back in 1911. So, this is just the beginning of this. So, I did some digging, and they kept mentioning the Black Hand. Have you ever heard of the Black Hand? Well, this is the Italian-Sicilian families in Chicago that were involved in, by the end of July of 1911, there were 45 murders associated with this group.
Oh my goodness.
So, there were lots of articles
on
the Black Hand. So, this one says, the murderous Black Hand, this was published in April of 1911, becoming serious problem in Chicago, where 35 men have been killed in the past year. Police admit an inability to deal effectively with the secret crime society.
Ooh.
So they would write these notes, extortion letters, and say you need to provide this amount of money or you're gonna get dead.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So these families were
running around trying to collect money and
fighting each other, and there was a whole problem. So there's a picture of this family.
Love the picture.
So here's
oh wow.
Here's dad, here's the older brother, Philip. Her name is Stina. That's the 14-year-old sister, mom, and then that's little Angelo.
Who went missing. Six.
Yeah. Well, they
That's a great family photo.
Right? And then I found pictures of the police were on this case. They wanted to find this little boy. But this Detective Revere, he's in a ton of articles. And he's he wants to get these crime families. He's having detectives go undercover. And there's these sting kind of operations.
Was it typical for the Black Hand to do things against children?
They didn't have any kind of moral compass.
Yeah. Really. Good choice of words.
Yeah. They questioned the father and they thought he had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were he kept changing his story.
Oh.
It all goes back to 1909. Okay. So there's two articles that have different motives. All right.
So the boy would have been four.
Right. But the boy is not really involved. So it's just the adults in the situation.
Okay.
So his dad, Antonio, and there's a Joseph Nicolosi, who's a saloon owner.
Ooh, okay.
So they're all, and this Nicolosi family has different saloons. So there's Joseph, there's Paulina, and there's Carlo Mello.
Oh, that's a fun, right? Fun name.
So Carlo Mello and Paulina are married. So Paulina, his wife, is said to be related to the Marinos.
Okay.
So if I do a little deeper dive, I could probably find if she's like a cousin or a sister-in-law, something. So her mom is also implicated, this Bianca Quadrona, and she supposedly was the one who got the money that was extorted from this kidnapping, and there was like a ransom note. I'll read you the ransom note. There's a whole, yeah.
Okay. They did not hold back in the newspapers.
No, they did not. So there is the first article that I found that had some kind of motive. This is Nicolosi. This is Joseph telling his side of the story. So this is Carlo Mello's brother. All right. So the story given to the inspector for the investigator revolves around a boyhood friendship of the Nicolosi brothers and Antonio Marino, the father of the boy, and subsequent bitter quarrel over a love affair in Italy. Then, when the families came to America, it was thought they had become reconciled. The Italians told of a near duel between Joseph Nicolosi and Antonio Marino, during which the former was said to have taken a revolver from the latter 3 years ago. It also touches on the murder of Mariano Zagoni, father-in-law of Joseph, in front of the Nicolosi Saloon at 1000 Gaunt Court in May 10th, 1909, which today remains an unsolved mystery.
Wow.
Secret enemies of Joseph tried to fasten that crime to him, and it was said to detain until the coroner's inquest. So, they're saying, did Antonio have something to do with this?
Yeah.
Then other articles said that they were godfathers to each other's children. So it seems like I feel like that's a big important role.
Yeah, you wouldn't be doing anything to your godchildren or their families.
Yeah. So they're like, Antonio's lost his mind. It wasn't us. I don't know.
Although today, to this day, family feuds can disrupt things like that, even if you were godparents, probably.
And it seems like the saloons were, you know, people getting intoxicated, old rivalries get, you know, words get mumbled.
Oh,
who knows? And they all carrying guns and just, like, ready to kill each other in the street. So that's the first motive. The second one I found was this. So, all right, the Black Hand was that infamous crime group.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a known member. So Marino thinks that it has to do with the killing of Modesto Barona. So
these names, you're doing a great job pronouncing them.
Thanks. So the letter that he got asks for a lot of money. Okay. They asked him for $10,000 at first.
Wow. Okay.
And he's telling the police, I make like $1.50 a day. Like, there's no I way am can not a wealthy man. Yeah. I don't know what they're pulling here. And so the letter, I'll read it to you. Dear Antonio Marino, we took your boy from your home this morning at 10 o'clock, and he's in good care with us now. All we want is $10,000, and the boy will be all right. If you give your boy's life, don't miss this. Oh, no, if you value. Give your money to a friend passing the house. The Black Hand. So it's
Yeah, the Black
and they
Hand.
Have, like, an image of a Black Hand that they put on the letters, too.
Wow.
It's, like, a symbol from Italy that they use.
Do you think that, because they say your boy, how do they say it?
If you value your boy's life, don't
miss this. Like, do they think that? Because Anthony's the brother, or Antonio's the brother.
Antonio's the dad.
Oh, is the dad. Okay.
Philip is the brother.
The brother, yeah. Okay. Oh my gosh, can you imagine getting that?
No, like...
And knowing and you can't pay
for
it?
Part of the article was like, the dad was missing for an hour. Like, the mother got the letter.
She was panicking.
She goes to the police station. And then there's part of an article where the father whispers to Stina, the daughter, and they're having a conversation in Italian, and then the mother is, like, mad. Like, you could tell she's upset about what they're talking about, and then the daughter tells the mother, so the police are, like, suspicious of this whole family.
Yeah, like, what are they doing?
Yeah, why is this happening?
And why put a six-year-old boy's in it?
Yeah. Like, what is going on? So, the father's trying to tell the police, I think it has to do with the death of Modesto Barona. Because in 1909...
Mm-hmm.
This was in March of 1909, so it's the same year as the death of the other guy. He is, he kills this Verona. Like, they were in a fight at the saloon.
Oh, boy.
They go outside, and they do, like, a face-off, and so he doesn't get convicted, though, because it's considered self-defense, because they both had their guns out, they were both fighting, and, like, so they just...
And I'm sure the police know...
Yeah.
What can go down if and they start messing with all of this.
And this Modesto guy was, like, a top member of this Black Hand mafia-esque type group.
Maybe the dad was going to his, like, leader people if he was involved with, like, a group. That's why he went missing, to try to, like, figure out a plan of how they were going to take revenge or something.
I'm sure he was like, I'm not going to the police first. He
wasn't going to give the names of those people to the police, or maybe even his wife.
Yeah.
But why the daughter? Why was he whispering to the daughter? It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know. It was... It's a very, very interesting take. So they are waiting. So the father scrapes up $500.
Yeah.
So then this Bianca comes and collects the money. So they know she's involved somehow. So then they're like, well, get the rest of the family. So they provided with all these names, like I mentioned, Carmelio, Nicolosi, he has a saloon, Joseph, his brother, his wife, and his mother-in-law. So took the money, and the police kind of didn't know that they were going to get arrested. It was kind of like a sting operation thing. So all four of them got arrested. Joseph got out because a real estate guy put in 10 grand to get him out, post his bail. The other three were still in prison. And
that's...
yeah. And getting convicted. And there's all these pictures. Look at Sam.
Oh, my gosh.
Little Angelo. He looks so tired.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. They said they were going to dress him in all white and release him at such and such a time during the evening.
So you're saying the person who took that photo was the people who...
No, this is the newspaper took this photo.
Okay, okay.
But they released him, and, like, he was wandering the street, and the police officers actually found him.
Wow.
And they're like, what's your name? And he's like, Angelo. And then they're like, all right, well, what's your last name? Yeah, he's only, like, 5 or 6 years old. He's just, like,
and just think about, like, family history, right? Like, I wonder how that story got passed down through generations.
Right. Yeah. So, this is a good one. So, they got him back. He's... Like, they marked the money that they gave them so that they... But the money was never found again.
Hmm.
And...
The $500.
Yep, $500.
So they were okay with the $500, even though they were...
Yeah, I think they scraped it up by, like...
Oh, by
like
all the
other
people.
Other gang-related...
Oh, my goodness.
...families. So they were charged with the crime. And then there was another note, okay? So then there was, like, a... Almost, I'm sorry. It's even written in Italian. Look at... They write...
Oh, my gosh.
And
look at
the left-handed, too, because it's, like, slanted.
Right, because it's going up.
Yeah, it's slanted that way. So I'll read you the apology ransom note. Dear friend, we wish to inform you that we are sorry. We made a mistake. We were informed that you had $10,000 in the bank. We have come to the conclusion that you are a laborer and not to do with much money. That you as a laborer and could not have so much. We ask you to excuse us at this time.
So you're, polite.
Your boy will be delivered on Friday. He will be dressed in white and in front of one of the depots in Chicago. Yours with regard. And this one was unsigned. To Antonio. Yeah.
That's crazy. Sorry, we misidentified you to be someone who's rich.
Oh.
We took your boy and please forgive me, my friend.
So weird, right? Like, were they writing this in, like, because they were taken?
Yeah.
And, like, they were we're giving the boy back now at this point?
So many questions. I wonder if that was typical, but I'm assuming not.
No, like, they were...
That would have been the one
Articles kept referring to this after. They were like, oh, this like we're cracking down on the Black Hand ever since this kidnapping. The killings have come to like lessen. So they did. This Nicolosi family was part of something because it slowed down after that. Either that or it was like they knew who the players were. So they were trying to be
to your point with like the left-handedness, I wonder if they had like a handwriting expert examine it. And
well, they said it was in the same handwriting as the original one.
Oh, okay.
So they knew it was from the same person.
Wow.
And it's really, really weird.
That's so crazy.
But I'm glad he got home.
Yeah.
I'm glad he was safe. And Antonio just seems like he could kill people and get away with it.
Right?
Like, who is he in with? And were the police, like, also?
Do they have them? Right. Are they tied?
Yeah. Because they knew Barona was bigger than him, they were okay with it. Like, I don't know.
And then the brother who got fault. Yeah. Then there's the brother who got
falsely. Yeah, why was Philip,
involved?
Did they know that he was part of like petty crimes? Right. And they thought that this was a way to get money from his dad.
Did you search specifically his name? The brother's name?
Yeah, I couldn't find anything after that. It was just basically a lot of Antonio's like story and the like, you know, he said, she said.
Yeah.
It was,
Yep.
And then there were threats against the police, of course, that they were like, we're not afraid of you guys. We're on your tail and you better watch it. And yeah.
Oh my gosh. I would never survive back then.
I know, but like the 1911, like precursor to like the mafia. Like the gangs. And there was even, I did a little bit of digging about the Black Hand, and it was prevalent in New York and, you know, the bigger cities too. We could do a whole series on this murderous Black Hand.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I love the pictures and like the actual image of the ransom note and like, I mean, the like apology.
Yeah. I thought it was a good one.
That's awesome.
Finally had some juiciness.
Awesome. Yeah.
And it wasn't like a terrible ending either, you know?
Right. Because he came, because he got released and they went on their way, maybe thought about their actions going forward.
They were home.
Awesome.
I'm like, apologize.
No, I know.
We're so sorry.
It was so proper, like, so kind.
Excuse us for stealing your child. Well, when they were interviewing the father, like, he was kept changing his story, so they sent him to a priest, because, you know, the Italians and the Catholicness, so they sent him to the priest to see if the priest could guilt him into telling what was happening. And
he must have been really trying to save the boy, but having to make his connections and not wanting people to know about it, which I guess you can't really blame him when you're trying to save your kid.
Right.
Well, that's great. That's a good one.
We'll have the pictures up our social media, so you can take a look.
Alrighty. So, Michelle, my story that I found was based off a family dispute around some artwork.
Cool.
Okay. And the cool thing about my story is the artwork that we're talking about from long, long ago is actually on display currently at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Highly sought after artwork.
Yes. So, the title of the article that I first found that made me get into the story was "Omaha Woman and Boston Niece Both Lay Claim to Portraits." So, let me tell you a little bit about the portraits first. So, the artists of the portraits were Blackburn. That's just how he went. He was a British immigrant who worked in Boston for 9 years before returning to England.
Okay.
And it was said that they believe that these portraits that he did were like his last that he did while he was over here in the U.S. And the cool thing about these portraits as well was that they believe the original frames that the museums have were carved by Paul Revere.
What?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And the two, and if you're near New York and want to look at these photos, they're in the Gallery 717. And what was really cool about them was that, let me pull them up so you can just have a visual here, who I'm about to speak about. So that's one, two, and then, so it's a husband and wife, and those are, I guess, a picture from the newspaper, what they looked like.
Samuel.
Yep. So, the cool part about
this was that there's a little bit of like history on the museum's page about them. So kind of already summed up quickly who they were. And it also kind of gave a listing of who had the portraits and when.
Like which possession,
trail.
Yeah, that's cool.
Which is cool because over here they're disputing about who it belongs to and things like that. So I'll get back to that one. But so the two portraits are of Anna Holyoake Cutts, and she was born 1735 and died in 1812.
Mm-hmm.
And Samuel Cutts, the husband, born in 1726 and died in 1801. And they're from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So, New England.
Nice. Yeah.
He was a sea merchant of the colonial days. And Anna, her father, was Edward Holyoake, who was the 10th president of Harvard College. Which was another interesting tidbit. They believe that when these were taken, these portraits were taken, that they had just recently been married. So not long after they were married. And, so now I'll get into a little bit of detail about how they were, the portraits were written about in the newspaper. So it said, Mr. and Mrs. Samuel Cutts of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And both of these textured paintings is fine. There is a Reynolds background for the lady, while for Mr. Cutts, the artist chose something decisively clever, though not at all unusual in the portraits of the day. The man is seated against a black wall, but a considerable part of that wall is an open window through which one gets a remote view of the New Hampshire coast, a little marina pictured included in the order for a portrait, seeing as he was like a sea merchant. Blackburn did quite enough when he transferred the fine color of the clothing and the fine expression of the faces on his canvas. It would have been in order for some of the other... would have been in order for some of the other early portrait painters to throw in a little piece of a portrait. To throw in a little piece of a landscape for the portrait. At least the beholder could have taken refuge from the wilderness or the woodedness on the faces. So I also read that even when people were doing portraits, sometimes they would like paint in different type of clothing to make it like fresh. So those were the two. And then it also had said that there was another painter. His name was J.S. Copley. He was from the U.S. And I think he got a lot of his influence from Blackburn because nobody else in the U.S. had painted like this before.
Yeah.
So I get to look up.
Right?
Yeah, you get to look up his. So then we get a little bit into the whole drama of the family. And what I think really sums it up is... one of the, I think it was the aunt, so I'm calling her the aunt. She had said it was an unwritten law of the family that these portraits should never be sold.
Oh.
So, you know, I'm sure maybe that could have been true, but, you know, who knows how that was said in the family. But I guess it's like a family heirloom, right? Like, you would want that to stay in the family forever, so I could get that. But the aunt in this story is Margaret Cutts Judson, and she's from Nebraska. Omaha, Nebraska. And she had married a lawyer, Harry Judson, from Omaha, but they divorced in 1917. And she actually saw the exhibit when it came to Omaha of her fourth great-grandparents and claimed that they were hers and that they had been given by her mom, Annie, and... So then she set out to try to get claim of her portraits. But there was kind of tiff and taff. You know, she was saying, oh, they used to hang on my mother's wall. My mother gave them to me. And then in comes the niece. So the niece is Louise Cutts Powell of Boston. She was born in 1887 and died in 1946. And she was saying that she actually was willed these portraits by her grandmother, which would have been the aunt's mom. And she kind of grew up being raised by the grandma because her, Louise, her mom died in 1907 from tuberculosis, and then her dad died in 1908. So she kind of lost her parents and her grandma took over. And the sad part that I read about her mom's passing was that the grandma Annie, Margaret's mom, mm-hmm. and the niece Louise, they were in California at the time of the mom's passing, and the grandma was ill, so they couldn't even make it to her own mom's funeral.
Aww.
Yeah, that like was actually written in the obituary of the mom that they couldn't make it. And so the aunt, I mean, sorry, the niece, Louise, actually has like some good evidence saying, I've been paying on the storage unit for 4 years where the portraits were. They were already ready to ship out and, you know.
Yeah.
And she did sell them. So she sold them to the Voss Collection in Boston, I believe. Let's see. Let me pull that up.
Well, they weren't under her ownership, like.
Right.
They were.
Right.
She knew where they were.
Exactly.
She was caring for them.
Yeah, and in that, like I was speaking about who had the paintings when,
mm-hmm.
it first was the sitter, so, of the portrait, and then it went to his son, Edward Cutts, and then it went to his son, Hampton, then it went to his son, Edward,
mm-hmm.
and then that's Edward Cutts, which was Margaret's dad, and then they were given to his wife, so Annie, and then it went down to the granddaughter, Louise, then it went down to Voss Galleries in Boston. It was on display there for quite a while, actually. It was 1919 to 1926. And then it goes to someone named Clarence Dillon.
Did he buy them from the gallery, maybe?
I think he bought them because in an article it said they were on, when she saw them, Margaret saw the painting, said that they were on sale or being sold for $15,000.
Whoa. Back then.
Yeah. And then so there was a little article I wanted to read called from Louise saying, shows letters from aunt. Last spring, continued Miss Powell, I wrote her that I was bringing them east to place them in a museum, and she replied, begging me not to do so. Miss Powell produced a letter to herself bearing Miss Judson's name, which says, among other things, I feel terribly about how you're taking the portraits east. You ought to make a will leaving them to my sister and myself. This letter, says Miss Powell, proves that she does not own the portraits and that at the time she had never even thought of claiming such ownership. My grandmother's will, a copy of which I have sent for, the records of my storage warehouse at Omaha, and my aunt's own letters are absolute proof of my ownership of the portraits, and in the face of such evidence, I cannot see how she can bring suit against me. And if she does, I am certain of the outcome, for right must prevail. So she ends up getting the portraits and selling them. So she kind of just does away with them. But I'd be curious from, you know, looking beneath all the articles and information, did they not talk anymore? Did they not carry on a relationship? Because that's so typical for people to hold these sort of grudges in the family.
Yep.
Where they just cut off all relationships, which is sad, you know, because they're family. But, you know, that is what it is. But as I started digging into Louise, she's quite an interesting character, this niece here. So she goes to college, and let me get how they stated it here. She went to college and graduated from the University of California in 1913, and she became a lecturer on color psychology and the science of names and numbers. Once we're done this, we should actually look into how she did this, because there's a couple articles. How to tell from numbers, what is your everyday self? And it says, this one's a little blurry, but it says, only a person's characteristics, but his abilities, his success, and his failures are shown by the values of the letters in his name. And it's like actually like a letter chart. that's Louise, and it got these numbers and how they relate and what it means, and it's almost like
numerology. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And then with colors, I'll have to show you the clearer version, but it's like you write out your name and then you connect the letters with the numbers and then you add up the numbers and it like tells you about yourself, right?
Astrology about your name.
And then the colors one says, how colors affect your health and pocketbook. Tell me what colors you like and I will tell you what you are. Miss Powell describes herself awakening to the possibilities of developing a personality when she discovers a bit of rose ribbon, effects of white, black, blue, red, green, etc. Men should change neckties often. And these are, you know, just, she knew who she was. She was just, and she wrote very well. Like, a lot of these columns that she did were actually quite funny and interesting to read.
She's quirky. Huh?
Yeah, very quirky. And quirky is her hairdo in this University of Nebraska 1912 yearbook. She's highlighted green there. So it's like a, I don't even know how to describe it. Yeah, it's like wide at the bottom and then kind of tears up into a little nub at the top.
She's looking at like the eyes, like the whites are.
But that's clearly going to be her, because see her here and then see her, let's see, where'd that other picture go?
Oh, yeah.
Like, the face shape is definitely...
Yeah, that's her.
Yeah. And what was another interesting thing about this lady here was she was of... I'm going to probably mess this up. It was Baha'i faith, which was basically... it says, the Baha'i faith is a religion that emphasizes a spiritual unit of all humankind. It was founded by the Baha'i something in the 19th century in modern-day Iran, and is believes in oneness of God. So it kind of like it's the unity, diversity, just bringing everyone together in harmony, which actually kind of sounds nice. But I mean, I've never heard of that ever. But so she was kind of known there for all of that, but. Very. And she died young too. I mean, her parents died young. She's 59, so
yeah.
I didn't look to be that she had children, but I did look that potentially Margaret went on to have some kids, the aunt there. But it was an interesting history of the portraits, kind of where they've been and, you know, where they are now and just their ties to.
How did they end up at the.
So.
In New York.
So I'm assuming that last person, because it doesn't say, because that's where they are now, it doesn't say, but I'm assuming that Clarence Dillon, who potentially bought them, it looks like they might have had them until 1979, potentially. So I'm assuming maybe they sold them to New York.
Or in a will left.
Right, something.
Left part of the estate to the museum. Yeah,
which is nice. I mean, if they're not going to be in the family, it's nice that they at least get to go on display somewhere.
Yeah, for other people to see them. Not hidden in someone's basement. Yeah.
So that was my story. Nothing too, like, wild, but I enjoyed sort of the history.
And interesting characters, too, that she had. Oh, like,
She was an interesting lady. But.
Cool.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Join us next time for the big
Bang
big story.
Thank you.